So we should continue with the second half. I will just stop at this slide here. And something else I want to mention here is then, so the way this works is that the at this point, after the initialization call is made, the tool is actually created in the command list. And I will have a short demo about that, how this actually looks like later, after I will explain one of these example applications. So if this looked a bit abstract now, you will see in more detail how this works when I get the demo. So just to recall the way this works is first you want defines a set of commands and these have these can have certain parameters. And secondly, the tool state is preserved between the commands. This way, the commands themselves don't have to be interactive, but they just, each of the commands is called once, or maybe also several times iteratively with certain parameters. They're executed and they give output, but it's not that within the execution of one command there are some interaction between user and tool. But this interaction is done by repeatedly executing the commands. And as I said already, we will see the demo of that after the next couple of slides. So if you really want to get into using or extending or modifying this framework, just some hints given here. Of course, one has to make sure that the different plugins that are defined or programmed to be part of the framework don't interfere with each other. I mentioned already one has to be careful about not using any media, any dependent output functionalities, but instead use this method, which will then be mapped to either the HTML or the text console commands. Okay, and this I mentioned already actually, of course, has a graphical user interface, which can be automatically generated for a plugin which implements this base interface. And we will see a demo of that, as I said already, but you can just see, just to get an impression. This is from a paper which I'm going to present on Friday at the main conference, where we programmed a plugin which makes the binding to the model checker spin. And the way this works here is that one uploads a UML model which contains the state chart and the other parts, and these are then translated to Promina, which is the input format for the spin model checker, which we can see here in this, this window here. And so there we can call different kinds of commands at the dynamic verifier, and one of them will be to execute or to analyze the UML model using the spin model checker. But as I said already, I will give a demo on that, so it's better to explain this then how it works. So so much about this framework. Are there any more questions about this? Otherwise, I will now present an example plugin for this framework in order to say in more detail how this can be used. Firstly, something one has to worry about if one wants to define such a plugin. Depending on what kind of checks are supposed to be performed, one has to of course make sure that one correctly implement the meaning of the diagrams as stated in the official definition document. And I said already, okay, they are stated informally, which may or may not be a problem if you want to implement tool support. And this again depends on what actually you want to analyze. If you're only mainly worried about static properties, then there's not so much one can misunderstand there. In terms of behavioral properties, one really has to look at the specification and the specification document rather closely, and there are some subtleties where things may be not completely clear. So, firstly, what one has to do is to define an execution semantics, for example, of whatever part of the domain notation one wants to use. Firstly, sit down and define this correctly, which doesn't actually have to be so much work, because usually one is not going to use all of the UML notation anyway. UML is a rather large notation and can be quite complicated, but for most applications one only needs a relatively small and simple fragment of the notation anyway. So only for that fragment for which one wants to implement an analysis plugin, one has to firstly sit down and try to think about the definitions and whether one actually precisely understands them, in particular if one wants to analyze behavioral properties. There one really has to do some bit of research there. But of course there has actually already been a lot of research in defining execution models for UML diagrams. Slogan of formal semantics for or precise semantics for UML, and this is also something one could try to reuse there. Of course, only the problem is usually that they are defined again in some kind of formal notation, which one has to learn first in order to understand what is done there. So this may be a bit more involved. So in some cases, it's probably just better to read the official definition document and hopefully not run into problems with ambiguities or things like that. Okay, so that's the first step. And this is also something we did actually when we implemented various plugins. We firstly sit down and defined precise execution semantics for the fragment of UML that we are using. And for us, it was especially important to have a semantics which is defined for different kinds of UML diagrams in context. So in general, as I said, there has been a lot of work already on defining execution semantics for UML, but most of that is concerned with single diagram kinds in isolation. And what we needed for our problem, at least, was to be able to analyze different kinds of diagrams that concern one part of a given system with respect to certain requirements. And for us, it would not be sufficient just to analyze state charts, but we have to analyze state charts with respect to whatever is specified in the class diagrams and maybe taking into account the implementation diagrams and so on. So for our particular problems, like in security, which I will shortly talk about in the next couple of slides. So that's why we had to, in our case, actually define our own execution semantics, because whatever existed before we could build on, but it was not completely enough for what we needed. And in particular, also something we needed, because we want to analyze that, is to model the actions in the UML diagrams and the internal activities explicitly. So in many of these execution semantics approaches, the actions, like sending a message or receiving a message or writing a value to an internal variable, they are in many cases only modeled as a black box in a way, just saying, okay, something is done here, but without even going into detail. And for our work, we actually needed to actually execute the actions and activities, to actually, whenever there's written that an attribute should be assigned a new value, then this should actually be done when our execution semantics is executed by our tool. So in a way, you could view this as a prototyping of what the system using the UML language as some kind of abstract programming language. So our goal is really not so much program generation in the sense that we really want to execute the UML diagrams in the running product in the end, but it's more that we want to simulate them and or to analyze the simulation or maybe model checking and things like that in order to establish that certain requirements are actually fulfilled on the level of the model. And so it's in particular about message exchange, this automatic also supports the fact that messages may be exchanged between different components or objects, and it also includes some kind of underlying, you could say, virtual execution machine for the UML diagrams, which handles all this stuff, that messages are passed from one object to another and so on. This is supported by the semantics which we define there. And so something which I just want to mention here now is, because we're interested in security dependability, for example, at that area you have to do a little bit more, because the requirements are usually formulated relative to either an adversary model or to a failure model, which sort of captures the influence, the possible influence of the environment of the system with respect to the software. Environment may mean also the hardware on which the system is executed and things like that. And in our approach, like we have some extensions for using UML to develop secure or dependable systems, and there you can include this additional information using stereotypes in the deployment diagrams, and the tool then from this information generates a threat scenario which captures the extent to which certain things can happen to the system by the environment, such as hardware failures or hackers trying to attack the system and so on. This, for our purposes, we had to include this still in this form of semantics. And our work here was based on earlier work by other people who used the abstract state machines also to define form of semantics for various diagrams. So the way this works now is that I don't want to really go into too much detail about this semantics definition, but the way this works is just as a general look at it, is that the assumption is that the system is executed in cycles and iterations, and each of such cycles, firstly, the system takes some input in the events, and here by system I mean the system which is modeled by UML diagram. So it takes some input events at a given part of the iteration, and then these events are distributed among the different subcomponents of this system. And these are specified in the deployment diagram, and they may be linked by different communication links, and so the messages are distributed via these links and via message queues that that store the messages that are present at a given point of the system at a given time. Then at a later point in time, the message will actually be delivered to the intended recipient, unless something is done by the environment which may stop or delay the message or may drop the message. And this is, again, ties to this adversary or failure model, which you may need if you have specific requirements, and that may influence what is happening here. But if no such problems arise in the execution, then the output is actually distributed to the relevant queues that store the messages on the communication links or on the output of the system. And this is one cycle of the execution of the system modeled by the UML diagram, and this is then iterated well, as long as the system is running. And so, as I said, I don't want to go too in detail, but just some information about this semantics. This, again, I mentioned this is based on abstract state machines, and these state machines are, again, well, mostly simply transition systems, as maybe a state chart is, in fact, more or less a transition system, only here we are now on a lower level. So the level of the actual execution model of the UML diagram. But there, the models are actually quite similar to what we actually have in 11.11 if we look at state charts. Only now the states are, well, have to be more precisely defined, maybe. It's not just syntax, but where this is defined mathematically, there's a so-called multi-sorted first order structure, which simply means that the set where you have different operations, and these operations may have certain received values and may give back output values, and you can specify requirements using first order logic on that level. And this, these abstract state machines are again are executed by iterating certain update rules which are applied to the state machines at each part of the system execution. So maybe I should explain that what I'm talking about here on these couple of slides is something that a user or an implementer of UML tools doesn't necessarily have to know, but it's more for someone who wants to, who's interested in the scientific foundations of this approach. But I just want to mention this to whoever is interested here. So, and yeah, also some details about that. For example, with respect to the communication which I mentioned, so because we also want to be able to analyze the UML models with respect to the question whether the communication between different components works correctly and maybe satisfies certain real-time constraints, we also have to define how the communication actually is supposed to be executed. So this explains this in a little bit more detail. So firstly, we assume that a component S of system A sends a message of this form to another component, maybe the component R. And here, op is the name of the operation that is called at the other object, and X1 up to Xn are the expressions that are sent as parameters. And so these messages, well, we just define in our semantics, we define a set of so-called events, and the messages are contained in that set. So the way this works now is, if S wants to send this message to R, this means firstly that S traces the message R.message into its own output queue. And this is so this expression is prefixed by R because R is the intended recipient of the message. Then, secondly, there is this underlying framework, this sort of virtual machine for the UML models, which includes, for example, a scheduler of the system A. And what the scheduler does now is to distribute the messages from the in queues to the corresponding output queues. So in this example, the message r.message is removed from the output queue of S, and the message itself is added to the input queue of of R. And at that point, we can remove this prefix R because it's already arrived at the component R, and it doesn't have to travel any longer. And R then removes message from the input queue and processes it as content. So this is a typical example here, but in general, of course, the message may be sent to an object which may be part of a system and which is maybe distributed in another part of the overall network. And this may mean that you cannot send it directly, but you firstly have to, the message has to be sent up to the overall system, and then it has to be communicated to the other part of the system. And there it has to be addressed to the relevant object. So this is a typical example which I explained here, but in general the communication mechanism may be a bit more complicated, but it's still supported by this execution semantics. And also something we have to do on the level of this execution semantics is because we have operation calls, and there the idea is that the object which was called can simply send back a return value without knowing who the sender of the earlier message was, because that's one of the ideas in object orientation, that you hide away this information. But of course, if you want to simulate or have a symbolic execution of this, the underlying virtual machine has to keep track of the sender, because otherwise it doesn't know where the return signal is supposed to go. And this we have to keep track of here also. Here I don't want to explain it line by line, but just to give you an expression, how using this abstract state machine approach, execution semantics can now be defined. In this example of the sequence diagram, this is a semantics of a simplified fragment of sequence diagrams, but it's a fragment that for our purposes is actually sufficient. And at that point it's really, it's understandable. It's written in sort of pseudocode, so anyone who can understand program code should also be able to understand this execution definition here. And it's not too much logic in here, I think, to not be able to understand it at all, because it's written in this sort of functional style. If someone just wants to use the tools, and the idea is, of course, in the end, that the developers in that diagram where I sketched how the overall framework is supposed to be used, that the developers are not required to look at this at all. And this is just the underlying stuff which whoever wants to implement which checks the behavioral property of sequence diagram, they have to look at something like this, some kind of definition of the sequence diagram execution, which can be made precise to be able to write it down as some kind of code. So this you can actually implement here. This you can actually execute. There are compilers for this notation. So that's just an example. Something else which would be nice to have here is to be able to use some kind of modularity concepts. And in UML, this is supported by the so-called packages, or particularly by the subsystems. And these allow you to put together different kinds of diagrams of various kinds, which define different view on a given part of your system. Could put them together just by drawing a package around them. And this we would like to also use in our approach here to be then able to analyze the different diagrams that are contained in such a package and to, for example, do consistency checks between like state charts and sequence diagrams or things like that. And therefore, also on our on the level of our execution semantics, we define the concept which is parallel to defining packages in UML, except that it's a little bit more complicated here, because On the syntax level, you only have to write a box, and then that's your package, and you're done. But on the semantics level, of course, you have to firstly define precisely what it means that the different kinds of diagrams are supposed to fit together. So if you had, as I mentioned already, this communication between different objects, and then you also have a deployment diagram, which you want to put together with different state charts, maybe, then, for example, these different diagrams should be consistent. So the object should only send a message, or should only be able to send a message to another object, if these are actually connected by a communication link in the deployment diagram, which is an obvious requirement, but if you want to implement this check, then you will have to put this information together somehow. And this is what we did also in this execution semantics, in what we call UML machine systems. And so these UML machine systems are also not defined technically here, I just want to mention that. The way this works now is that UML machine systems consist of UML machines, which again can be defined as I showed for the sequence diagram example on an earlier slide. And if you put several of them together, maybe for example one UML machine for each object in the system, then you can put them together to a UML machine system, which then models the execution of the package which contains these different objects. And the way this works then is that, just to explain this shortly, each of the components in the system, for each of them we have to do these three steps which I defined earlier, namely that the input queue is updated with the messages that should be added, which are received by other objects. Then the scheduler is called, which schedules the different objects, the execution, in a certain way, which can be defined using activity diagrams. And after the scheduler calls these different subcomponents, they do their execution, and they will produce outputs. And these outputs from the output queues firstly have to be distributed to the link queues, and then also to the output queue of the overall system. And this is really all that's happening there. And that way you can put together different components within one package and then also execute that together.
Are the links within the package or between packages?
They can also be within within a deployment diagram which can be contained in a package. So you can look at that at different levels. The way we do this here is A is a package which contains a deployment diagram, and the deployment diagram contains the communication links between different nodes in the system. And that way, these are the links that connect the sub parts that are contained in a given package. But you can also then go up one step. So maybe if I had a pen, I could draw this here, but I don't have just like this small one. I don't think you can read this. Just try. Can you see this now? Okay. So this is a package. Which is just this box with this label here, and the way we do this here, that the package can contain different kinds of diagram types. So for example, like the state chart, we don't have to really read this in detail, I just want to sketch something, state chart, and then, this would be nice if you could have this pen anyway. And maybe a deployment diagram which would consist like of nodes that are then connected by links, communication links. So these nodes are these boxes in a deployment diagram. The boxes may be connected by solid lines which connect communication thing. And here you may, while the old, you may want 5 notations, you may have these components in here. Well, you don't actually have to read this in detail, but well, there may be stuff sitting inside these components here. They may also be connected by dependencies again and so on. And so you may have a bubble diagram and a state chart maybe for a certain object, and also maybe a class diagram. That's a simple one here. And so the links are, well, in a less sense, the links are contained in the package, and they connect different nodes which are part of the package. But you could also actually go one step up and take this as the specification of one component of the system, and
since this is not a tutorial on security,
and you're probably not so much working into security either, then I just want to sketch what is supposed to happen here. What you need to know about this example is only that it is in fact possible to consider security properties on the level of the UML design model. You can verify the model against for security requirements by considering an attacker model, which can also be defined on the model level, and against which, which is generated from the threat scenarios that are contained in the deployment diagrams, as I mentioned earlier. And against this attacker model, the security requirements are then verified. And the attacker model works specifically in a way that you can view it as another object in the system, which takes part in the system execution in a certain way, for example, by reading messages that are exchanged over internet links or things like that, and maybe also inserting messages into internet links and so on. And so there are certain things this this additional node in the system can do, and the characteristic feature of this additional node is that it is very non-deterministic and inherently unpredictable. So we don't know what it is exactly going to do, but we just say that there are certain things that the adversary can try to do, like reading messages on internet links or inserting messages into internet links and so on, because these are things that are rather easy, these are attacks that are really rather easy to perform against the system. And in fact, we also use a similar kind of approach when we consider dependability, where we worry more about messages being lost or being delayed rather than being read or being inserted or things like that. But it works in a similar way. Instead of having an attacker model, we there have a failure model, for example, which models the fact that certain messages may be delayed or may be lost when they are communicated over a particular communication link. These adversaries are somehow modeled on the level of the execution semantics, and to verify the security requirements, then the execution semantics is executed together with this non-deterministic adversary model. This I don't want to explain in detail here, but in particular in the example application I will present in a couple of slides, the system specification contains cryptographic algorithms, and these we also we want to verify that these are used correctly within the system specification. So, for example, the example I will present is a cryptographic protocols where cryptographic algorithms are used to encrypt and sign certain data which is exchanged between two servers on the internet in order to build up a secure communication channel over a network which, to start with, is not trustworthy. The point here is that in order to analyze the correct use of cryptography, we have to view it as an abstract operation. It's not feasible to analyze the system down to the bit sequence level, where there's complicated mathematical operations performed by the cryptographic algorithms that just wouldn't be feasible to analyze that in an automated way. And therefore, we just view the cryptographic algorithms such as encryption, decryption, and so on. We just view them as abstract operations. And a similar thing you could do in other areas, such as fault tolerance. You might have some error detection or error correction functions, and there you would probably also be able, and this is also something we looked at actually, to do it in the same way by viewing these functions as abstract operations and not going down on the bit sequence level. So the assumption is that the error-correcting codes or the cryptography itself is implemented and working correctly, but you can analyze UML models to establish that these functions are used correctly within the system context. This is just the technical definition how this can be done to view these cryptographic operations as abstract functions by defining a term algebra in which the encryption operation is just a function symbol, and by defining certain equations which you need in cryptography, for example, that if you decrypt a ciphertext with the correct decryption key, then you get back your original plain text. Okay, and this is an abstract view of this adversary model, which is executed together with the execution model of the system, where as I said, the adversary at certain communication links in the system may be able to read and memorize messages that are exchanged, and may even be able to delete or insert messages into the communication links. And yeah, just to get a bit more of an idea about what how this can happen is, I just want to give this example here of a simulation of this adversary model in a specific situation. So here we have a system which is distributed over the internet, which consists of two parts, A and B, and we consider a certain protocol which is supposed to be executed among the different participants there, and the way this is specified is this sequence diagram, and we want to analyze this sequence diagram with respect to the security requirements which we have against this protocol, and for that we have to take into consideration an adversary model which sits in the middle and may non-deterministically interfere with the execution of the protocol. So, for example, the component A may send out a message M with argument X with intended recipient B, but there's this adversary sitting in the middle and reading the message, and the adversary may have some initial knowledge about certain public cryptographic keys or things like that, and this knowledge is then increased with execution of this this model. So here the adversary also knows the argument X now, and so the next thing, the adversary may, for example, choose to forward the, to actually forward the message to the intended recipient B. And then the B performs a certain check here and returns a certain value again with intended recipient A. And again the adversary receives the value instead firstly and may do certain computations here, may increase his knowledge, and in the end may choose to forward another message to A. In this case, the adversary in fact forwarded a message which was different, or an argument here, which was different from the one received from B earlier. So that's also something which we have to assume that the adversary is able to do at this point. For example, with respect to internet links. So just as a background, because I wanted to explain how we did this tool binding here of this sophisticated analysis of the mail models. So this couple of slides I just explained are sort of the domain knowledge which you would have to know in order to be able to come up with this kind of analysis plugin for the general framework which I defined earlier. And so the way we chose to do this analysis now is to translate the given a sequence diagram, as we saw on the previous slide, translate the relevant information from the sequence diagram to first order logic, and also translate the security requirement, namely that, for example, a certain message which is communicated actually remains confidential and will not be read by an adversary. This is also translated to first order logic. And the way this is done now, just to explain this shortly, is that there are the predicate nodes of E in first order logic which we define, which means that the adversary may get to know the expression E during the execution of the protocol. And for the secret S, we can then check whether nodes of S holes in within these first order logic formulas which were derived from the domain diagram using an automated serial remover. And so the goal is that the developer uses the UMA framework, as I explained earlier, draws the sequence diagrams and specifies in the class diagram which values are supposed to remain confidential, and then the tool automatically generates a first order logic formula, inputs this to an automated serial prover. The serial prover will get back a result, either true or false, and then the user, the developer, will get back the result either the protocol is secure in the sense that this information will remain confidential, or it is not secure. So that's the goal. Yeah, I don't want to explain this in detail here, but just to for you to get an impression here. The way this works roughly is that firstly we have to define a first order logic formula which keeps track or which formalizes the fact that the adversary may increase his knowledge by himself making use of certain cryptographic information. If he has a certain cryptographic key, then he can encrypt a certain message using that key, and will also have this the result in his own knowledge and can make use of that. So this is captured by this formula down here. And then, given such a domain diagram, which looks a bit complicated here because there are different kinds of cryptographic expressions included. On the one hand, in the SS arguments of the messages, and on the other hand, within the guards which have to be fulfilled so that the sequence diagrams continues with the execution. That's why it looks a bit complicated, but the principle is just a sequence diagram, and this is then this is the one part of information that the developer is presenting. And then also there's the deployment diagram where there's an internet link between two links and between two components of the system. And this information is then translated automatically, as I said, to further logic. So and this you can actually also do for state transpositions instead of sequence diagrams. So again, I don't want to explain it in detail, but this is how it's done anyway. This is implemented by our tool. For this particular example, the result is in a formula sort of like that, with a little bit more in here, but these are sort of the first two lines in the protocol give this part of the formula here. And then you also want to specify an activity diagram to say how the two components are executed. And you can also formulate the data security requirements in the class diagram by saying, for example, that certain keys or certain values that are exchanged should remain secret. And then the tool will check whether, for example, S actually remains secret, and this is done by checking whether this expression nodes of S is derivable from the formula which was generated from the diagram. And the example which I spoke earlier was actually a proposed variant of the TLS protocol, which is the current version of the SSL protocol, which is the which is used in many internet browsers to protect HTTPS connections. And so, just to say roughly how this works is this. So this is now a package, a new mail package, which contains these different subdiagrams, which I showed on the previous slides. This we drawn in Poseidon, and this is then translated to the input file for the automated peer improver in a certain notation called TPTP notation. This is a fragment of that that input file. That's the second part, actually.
What is
TPTP? That's short for 1,000 problems of peer improvers or something like that. Which is just an input notation for automated peer improvers. Okay, and then actually what comes out, so the developer, or actually the output from this automated peer improver, then says proof out, which in our formalization of the problem is actually means that there was actually an attack against this protocol. You can just, so you can derive nodes S, so this protocol does not preserve the secrecy of S against the first piece. And also something else, or I don't want to get into detail here because it's not really the point of this tutorial, but we can also use a different plugin to actually come up and show what the attack is against this protocol. And you can also define a fix and prove that this is actually secure. So, at this point I just wanted to make this a bit more concrete, this presentation. Wanted to show, give a short demonstration of this framework. So I just tried this in the break, but I should just start it again to show you how this works from the beginning. So just shut this down. Exit. Okay. Probably cannot read this. Let's see if I increase or decrease the resolution, then this might, I don't know if this is risky with respect to the projector, because then he may not be able to see us anymore, but just try this, because I don't think you can read the writing there, and it will be the same problem with the tool. Let's see. Just very quickly. Any questions at this point? Let's try this. Okay, this doesn't help because I'm using VMware and it just makes the window smaller. So, okay, I will just try to talk you through that anyway. Okay, so let's see. So the first thing to do is to start this framework, and I just have a link there to start this. Okay. Now this this wiki framework is started. It's based on Java. You can see some messages there, and so this is now the graphical user interface for this framework. As I said, there's also a web interface, so what we have here, we can load files, save files, and peer the repository. So let's do this first. Let's load in LoomL, the agram, which I constructed earlier, in which I, using this Poseidon tool, which I save in this Zargo format. So the way this works in Poseidon is that, as I said earlier, it uses XMI internally as the saving format, but the point is that XMI so far does not contain graphical information itself. It only contains the actual content, the conceptual content of the UML models, but not the layout of the UML model. This is actually being changed at the moment, but with previous versions this this was not contained, and therefore when Poseidon stores the model, it includes an XMI file, but it also needs some additional information describing the layout. And these different files are put together into a zipped archive, which has this Zargo extension. Okay, so we want to upload this example of this TLS variant, which I mentioned just now. And this is now loaded into the framework, so we see some things happening here in the output. And, well, it takes a little bit of time to load this into the MDR framework, but then, yeah, we are there. And, okay, so now the UML model is in the framework, in MDR, and now we have a number of tools which we have been implemented, a number of analysis plugins for this framework, which we could now execute with respect to this UML model. So I don't want to explain all of these, but well, there are some dynamic checks performed. So here, this is, which one is this, I think, I don't actually know what this is doing, but there are two static checks, then this MDR viewer, this is the browser which I mentioned earlier, then an activity parser, a sequence diagram parser, a state chart parser, a subsystem parser, and some other checks, state chart export, and the one we're interested in here is sequence diagram analyzer, which in the current version actually of the framework as it is running on the web server automatically gives the input file to the automated theorem prover. Here the problem is that this automated theorem prover only runs under Unix, and I have this framework installed under Windows here, so I don't have the binding actually installed on this on the laptop here, but it's running on the web server anyway. So here I have to, it's a bit more complicated, it's not completely bound together. But I can just show you, okay, if we can now call this command, which says display a TPTP, and that's what it just did. We don't see anything because here in the bottom we have to select the right tool in the output window, so I can just do it again. So I should have selected that earlier. Let's see. We do this again, display TPTP. Well, it doesn't, we don't see much clear. No. Just load it again, I guess. So we at least see what's happening. Oh, ah. We'll unload the current model. So if we load a new model, then the current model is unloaded from the MDR repository. Just do it again. Ah, okay, so we have to do this. Okay, yeah. And then just so you see what's happening, I want to do this again. Sequence analyzer, display TPTP. Yeah, okay, it's very quickly, so you don't really see much, but it just outputs this TPTP file, which I actually had on the one of the previous slides very quickly. and write that input file to the automated serial prover. And as I said, now on the version which is implemented on the web server, this would be automatically given to the DPDP to the automated serial prover. I have not installed this on the laptop here, but just to demonstrate this, I have to copy this from hand now to the Linux partition. The way we did this here is that we can also save the file on the disk, and it is stored in a temporary file in some temporary directory. And if I just copy this to the serial prover directory and I start this here, so I did this in the break with another example, but now I have to use the new file 135, and then give some parameter for the serial prover, and then gives back a lot of internal results which are not interesting to the user. But here it says, you cannot even read this because we have some problems. Let's see. Here in the end it says proof found. So that's what I said earlier. This here actually means that the protocol is insecure, because it means that the secret is being leaked. Okay, but as I said, in the actual implementation, which is correctly implemented on a web server, unfortunately I cannot demonstrate it here because I don't think we have internet here, but you can try it with the link which is given in the slides. There now we would get back the result, not all this information here, but just the result that the secret is actually being leaked to the adversary. Okay, so there's so much just for a simple short demo, just to demonstrate how this is supposed to work overall. So we have some time left, and in the remaining time I just wanted to give an overview over some other approaches which are quite interesting. Are there any questions at this point? Okay, so I will just. Design patterns for the UML modules. That's also an interesting thing we are also working on at the moment. So the way that we view design patterns is on the model level, you can apply a design pattern, and this application of the design pattern is results into a transformation of the UML modules. So you have, this general approach to design patterns as it is presented in these books by different people, Bushman and Gamma, Eric Gamma, and there are a couple of books on these things from 95. I think the usual presentation is a pattern, design pattern consists of four parts. Firstly, the problem description, then another thing was the solution, and also information about what the solution achieved, and then information about where you can apply this solution. I think these were the four parts, if I remember correctly. And if you want to translate this or use this in the UML setting, the application of the pattern which gives you a solution for a problem which occurs in many places. This is in UML, on the UML level, is a transformation from one UML model to the other. Namely, from the one UML model, which I think actually we should have. Actually, I can give you. I can show you a slide where I have an example for that. Let's just see, because otherwise the explanation is a bit abstract here. 1 second. Patterns. Ah, yeah. Okay. Let's just do this for a moment. So this was again in the setting of security, but it really works in the general setting. So I mentioned this design patterns by Buschmann and other people, and well, this is just an example. Design patterns, secure channels. So that's a typical problem in security. You want to set up a secure communication channel over an untrusted network. So that's the pattern. You can use the cryptography and use the security protocol and so on. And so the way this is being done now is, okay, first we define this domain specific thing, secure channel abstraction and so on. And yeah, so that's what I really wanted to show. On the level of the UML models, this is the application of a pattern, is the transformation from a model to another model. And in this example, this is a model where we simply say, okay, our problem is that the communication between the two nodes should be protected. This is transformed into a model where there's actually the solution included in the model. Namely, in this case, it's these are two state charts which define a security protocol. Okay, so it's what I just want to say here is that application of a design pattern is a transformation. In this case here, from a diagram which has this kind of form in principle, not only this particular diagram, of course, but any diagram where in this case there are two components connected by a communication link which should be protected. And transformation to a diagram where this communication link is substituted it's enhanced with the definition of this security protocol. That's one view on these design patterns. This is really just, I just want to explain the idea because you asked the question. And in that sense, you can actually make use of design patterns in, firstly, of course, on the level of UML models, and then more specifically also in the context of this kind of tool support, because so the plugin which we haven't actually implemented yet, but we're working on that. What that plugin would do would to take a UML model as input from the user of the framework and modify the UML model, for example, in the example I showed you, by including the security protocol or doing whatever you need to do to apply the design pattern. And this you can also do within the context of this framework which I showed. And then the user will receive back the UML model which includes the modified, or which is modified following this design pattern. If that answers the question. Okay. And in fact, yeah, so this the general thing you want to do there is model transformation, which is of course also a topic which is looked at in quite a lot of approaches at the moment. I'm sure there will also be a couple of talks on the main conference. And in fact, in the section which I am presenting now about other approaches, the second one is also in fact just about exactly about that, namely defining transformations on UML models. So in a couple of slides I will come back to that question there. But firstly, I wanted to tell a little bit about this tool which I mentioned earlier, which is in a way a sort of historic background to the work which I have been presenting in this tutorial. So firstly, just say what this is, and in fact this is also a similar tool to what I presented here, except that here in this tool, this started out rather early, namely in 96, when UML was really just defined, and there weren't really many UML modeling tools around. So this was also defined in our group, and the people there decided to define their own editor, which had the UML-like notation, pretty much almost UML, but they defined their UML, their own editor, and they did all kinds of sophisticated analysis plugins for that. So for example, you can simulate the models, you can validate them by consistency checks, testing, model checking, and so on. You have code generation to Java, CA data, connection to MATLAB, and things like that. So some history about that. So as I said, it was started out in 96, and well, there were various features added over the last couple of years, which I already mentioned, and actually in 4 years ago, the people who started out this work founded a small company that now does this, continues this work on an industrial context. And so what I want to mention here is, because it's interesting from a case tool point of view and also interesting for analyzing UML models, of course, because it's really the same, same thing. So and that's why I just wanted to quickly explain how this is done in this particular application. So firstly, explain the architecture of this case tool. And it's actually, in a way, under the hood of this of the user interface, it's a similar architecture to what I presented in the what I presented so far, in the sense that on the one hand, you have this editor, autofocus editor. On the other hand, you have an application which contains all these analysis plugins and also does the model storing as an XML and so on. And so it's also a two-part architecture. Although here, in this case, the user, well, okay, yeah, the user, of course, doesn't see that there are the two-part architecture, but just uses the application, which includes the editor and the analysis plugins. Whereas in the framework, which I presented earlier, the user firstly uses an industrial UML editor, stores the model, and then uploads it on the web interface, for example, to have it analyzed. So you could say in what I presented, there's one step more to do, and well, if you do it a lot of times, it may be a bit inconvenient. But I don't know, for the moment it was fine with us, but this is really what they did with that tool there. And this was the original autofocus tool, and later they added these analysis plugins at that point. Actually, I want to shut off the animation here. So, yeah, that's the overall architecture, and yeah, and just to explain quickly how this is done internally in this tool, so in fact they had a similar kind of meta model there as quite similar to what is done in UML. So also this meta-modeling approach, and there are different kinds of diagram types, which are, as I said, quite similar to the UML diagrams. And you also have the repository, where you also have a kind of browser. So really quite similar, only slightly different notation, and integrated tool with editor and analysis machines. And that's how that looked in the tool. So you also have different views as in the real UML, and it's actually a bit closer to the real-time UML, which was until now different from the mainstream UML, although in UML 2.0 they're really being in some way put together with the capsules integrated into UML in the mainstream. And so this is how this looks in that tool. You have different capsules there, and you may have associated state machines. And this is how you can look at that in the editor. This is the underlying meta model for, the underlying model for this example. And similar to what I said in the UML case, for example, here you have a transition with certain labels, and these are contained in this this UML model of this this syntactic diagram, and these can be analyzed by the tool support contained in the tool. Okay, so much about this short overview about this autofocus tool. Then coming to transformations, which again comes back to the question about applying design patterns. As I said, there's quite a lot of work on transformations in the context of model-driven architecture or model-based development, because that's really the main activity you would like to do eventually. Firstly, to construct a UML model, and then to transform the the UML model, maybe in an iterative process, to a UML model which contains more detailed information, or maybe to transform it to apply design patterns, to maybe to transform it to correct certain flaws in the design which you notice by using the analysis tools. So you will have a lot of transformations done during development in terms of refinement or improvement or maintenance, whatever. And also, of course, you want to come down from the business model down to firstly the platform-independent model, and then lastly to the platform-specific model and the implementation as possible. So transformations are quite central to the model-based development process. And one example is given here. Here you have this platform-dependent model of a business entity and an account being transformed to the platform-specific model, where this this class is implemented in a Corba environment, where you have certain interfaces which allow you to do certain things with respect to this this account. This is just one example for such a transformation when you go from the platform-independent model to the platform-specific model. And now it would, of course, be convenient to have a language to define these kind of model transformations in a universal way, and also to have tool support associated with that. And this is something too... something I forgot about the... autofocus tool, of course, in the end there are references about who did that, a couple of colleagues of mine. And similarly here, with respect to this work here, some other colleagues of mine now did define this transformation language and also implemented the tool. And there's also a reference about their work in the end of the tutorial. So what they did there, Peter Braun and Franz Marschall, in the last couple of years, they define this transformation from the source model to the what we want to be able to define a transformation from a source model to a target model, and here again both the source model and the target model have an associated meta model which may be the same, but it may actually be different. If you want to transform a UML model to maybe even to code, then you good principle also included in this framework. And in that case, you would have different meta models there. Here the UML meta model, and there the code-specific meta model. And yeah, you want to define this transformation in a universal way. And well, incidentally, of course, in a way that that this transformation, of course, has to satisfy the relationship when you go from the source meta model to the target meta model. So in a sense, whichever way you go, whether you go from the source model to the meta model to the target meta model, or the other way around, this should be the same thing. So this diagram should commute in a certain way. Should be consistent. That's something you have to make sure if you want to define this this kind of framework. So what they defined there was this so-called bottle language, which allows you to define these kind of transformations. Formally founded in the sense that this context of this meta-modeling approach, which I explained earlier, and it's rule-based in the sense that you can define rules where you can transform models by, for example, making clip-ins into a target model and to merge them. That's one thing. And you can also do other things, other kinds of rule-based transformations. And this can actually be linked to automated verification plugins as the ones that I presented earlier. So the way this works now is that the object models as instances of the UML model can actually be transformed. This is so much about this, this tool, so it's just an example here where here in this example this class model is, can be transformed to this larger model which contains much more information. It's a refinement of the earlier models, and that's an example there. And now getting close to the end now. Firstly, I still wanted to give a bit of an outlook to the upcoming UML 2.0 version, which is by now pretty much done. I think we're just still waiting for the official release from the OMG, but you can still you can already download the new specification, and this is really pretty much how it will stay, except maybe for some minor bug fixes. Only something I have not seen yet is actually the new DTD for that. So if you want to use the UML UML version in this kind of context, you again have to need to have a DTD file which defines the translation of the MOB model to the XMI format. But this should be coming soon, as I said. So now just point out what changes can be expected here, with respect to the issue of developing advanced UML tool support. So firstly, of course, there are some new diagram types in UML 2.0, which one might want to support also with the tool support, or one might choose not to support. So this is more or less a problem of whether one wants to extend one's tool support to take this into consideration, or whether one doesn't want to do that. That's sort of one's own decision. Then something else which is less of a deliberate decision is that there are actually some changes in the execution semantics. And for example, this applies to the activity diagrams, which previously in UML were simply defined to be a special case of state charts in terms of execution semantics. So up to now, one simply could implement state charts in terms of an execution semantics and the tool, and on top of that, one could implement the activity diagrams by simply saying that in an activity diagram, this is a state chart where the state space is divided up into different swim lanes which correspond to the different actors. But the execution really was identical. Now it has changed, and the activity diagram and execution semantics is now defined in a slightly different way based on patchiness. I'm not quite sure yet whether this actually comes down to the same thing. Of course, you could hope that although they are now defined in a different way, it really comes down to the same execution. But I heard from some people who looked into that that with some issues there are actually some changes, which unfortunately means that if one really takes these things very serious and one defines tool support for UML 1.5 activity diagrams already and wants to use them with UML 2.0, then there may be some changes necessary, which is a bit annoying, which happened to us actually in fact, but okay, that's something you have to live with, I guess. And then something more down to the implementation level is changes in the diagram interchange. This I mentioned already, and this is more of a, well, you could say, a welcome change, because, as I said already, in UML 1.x, the layout information was not contained in the XML files, which had the disadvantage that if you exchange XML files, then you want to display your UML model in a different tool. Then the question is, how does is the tool supposed to know where the diagram, for example, the class diagram, where the object is supposed to sit on the left or the right hand side? And this makes a difference if you know in terms of psychological or usability aspects, because you want to see the class diagram in a specific place, that's why you put it there. And so far, there was no real solution for that. I mean, some tools support that they automatically define the layout in a way which is supposed to be nice, but it may not look nice to you anyway. And of course, you can still sort of import an XML file. You can do this by hand and put the various parts where it's supposed to be, they're supposed to belong. But it's, you know, it's a bit annoying to have to do this manually. And this is changing now because this information, the layout information, which doesn't really contain any semantical information, but it's just, you know, it's just syntax, but it's still important for usage. This information is now included in the actual XML file, starting for the UML 2.0 specification. And this is in progress. So some people involved in that were actually the ones who, the company who develops this Poseidon tool, and they have also some information about the process on the website. Okay. Now we are actually already into the lunch break. I had an exercise sort of prepared for where I, well, firstly I wanted to explain this another kind of check, and I distributed these handouts where there's actually, you can actually see the code for the analysis plugin, but I think we're a bit short on time here now, so unless someone really wants to do the exercise now here and explain how this works, I would say, well, you can take this with you and try to understand the example. And if you have any questions about that, then you can just write an email. So maybe that's the best option at this point. Unless someone wants to look at that right now. Okay. Or maybe if, I mean, I will still be around until next Friday, the main conference. So if you just have a look at it now, if you have any questions next couple of days, you can just come to me and we can talk about that. So, okay. Then, yeah, demo we already had, and much for the exercise. Discussion, any comments? any ideas by you? What is your impression about providing tool support for in the context of UML? So I hope this didn't look too complicated didn't scare you off looking at the issue. Yeah, I mean, the analysis statement I gave there was, I would say, one of rather challenging approach, because I mean, this security verification is challenging in itself, and dealing with UML is not trivial either, because it's quite a complex notation, and putting that together is quite a lot of work. So this is, at this point, this kind of work is still on the research level, I mean, applied to security. I don't know any opinion of you, but I think that the less heavyweight applications of analysis of UML models are really quite practical today already. And I mean, I sketched different kinds of approaches you could follow, including these script-based parsing approaches using SSLC or so, or the data binding, which I talked about mostly in this tutorial. I think these are already some practical tools already there. So, I don't know, any impressions, opinions about these issues? Mm-hmm.
You described a model checking mm-hmm. tool based on theorem proving. Mm-hmm. Have you tried any tools based on state exploration?
Yes, so that's, this is actually something I will present in the talk on Friday. We also connected this framework to the spin model checker and did a similar, in that case it was also security verification, also with respect to crypto protocols, but by calling the spin model checker. If you compare that, there are certain advantages and disadvantages of using automated theorem proving or model checking in terms of practical applications. So model checking, the disadvantage maybe is that there may be some resource limitation. So in model checking, you always have this state explosion problem, which means that if you consider a reactive system, where there may be interaction between the system and its environment, and at each point of the iteration there are several options which the environment could take, for example, then the state space grows exponentially with the length of execution of the system. And then by trying to analyze the model by exhaustive state search, one can realize that this gives you a problem if you have a large model or if you want to consider the system over a long period of execution. Of course, there has been a lot of work been done in universities and also industry on enhancing model checkers, state-based model checkers, and there are quite good tools now which include a lot of improvements, but still with something such as security protocol verification, you still run into limitations, because especially you have this non-deterministic adversary model in there, which at each iteration can do very many things, and you have to try them out, all of them. And
presumably, the theorem prover also has to generate many alternatives and search them. Your experience is that it's more compact.
So in our approach, which I shortly sketched here, which is now, of course, specific to the security verification, what we did was rather than constructing a complete execution model and then executed symbolically, as we did in the model checking approach, in the theorem proving approach, we started sort of from the more abstract level, and we constructed a more abstract model from the UML diagram to start with. And this is there's also a lot of work done on the label of abstract interpretation in research, as in academia, and also industrial tools. I mean, this is not something we invented, but you can also apply this to UML diagrams. The idea is there that extract a certain amount of information from the UML diagrams, however much you need to analyze a certain property. So in this example, what I showed here in this tutorial, what we did to simply to generate this this first order logic formula, which is relatively compact then, and which only captures the things that the adversary can do and the knowledge that the adversary can gain. So it doesn't actually contain an execution model of the sequence diagram, not completely, but only what the adversary can see of the system. And therefore, it's more compact to start with, firstly. And secondly, the automated theorem prover does the analysis in a different way. Instead of exploring the state, it tries to apply different kind of derivation rules, and this is just more efficient if it's possible to formulate the problem in this way. Then it's really more efficient because it's not state enumeration but just application of rules. And okay, something else which is sort of in between, which we also tried, is to use a prolog-based approach. And this is sort of in between the automated theorem proving and the model checking, because there the properties are also formulated in first order logic, and more specifically in Horn formulas, because that's the prolog notation. But what a prolog does is really more an explicit state space. And there we also noticed that it can take a rather long time, and the prolog compiler can actually get stuck because it has this depth-first search. And if in one particular branch of the search tree there's no solution to be found, then it may get stuck there. Unless you tweak the prolog implementation, then it gets out this branch and gets to the solution. So, and then for this example, the theorem prover actually worked much more efficiently and much more nicely. But of course, the disadvantage of that is that you only get a yes or no answer. And with model checking, if the property is not fulfilled, you automatically get back a counterexample, which can of course be very helpful. And that's why actually in our code we use the two approaches together. So we firstly use the theorem proving approach to find out whether there is a problem at all. If not, we are happy. If there is a problem, we use the model checking approach to get the actual counterexample. And that works quite nicely, I think. Okay. Any more comments or questions about the topic in general? Then I think we should get to lunch slowly. So there's some conclusions. So it is now actually possible to actually do tool support and sophisticated analysis of UML models, and actually also in a formally based approach. So I gave an example for that of this theorem proving extension. You can do this in an automated way, and also to have it integrated. So this is something I only mentioned in the beginning, but in the same way as you can analyze UML models, of course you can also in principle analyze the source code and the configuration data. And we have actually done some work where we put these analysis routines together. So you can compare the UML model of a business process with the permission, the security permission stored in the SAP system, and see whether they are consistent or things like that. So that's again the goal, and I think it's we're eventually going to get towards achieving that. I mentioned some literature. You can, if you're interested, you can look it up on the web. So I used some of the slides in the introduction to MDR, which I found quite useful. Then this approach to this autofocus tool by a colleague of mine, and this transformation language by two other colleagues. And while there's of course there are a lot of more approaches to tool support for UML, which I cannot name all of them. So for example, also a couple of them presented at previous UML conferences. Something which is actually relatively close to what we are doing is some colleagues at the other University of Munich, the LMU University, they did a similar thing where they constructed the UPI model checker, they linked the UPI model checker also to a UML based tool. Okay, some resources. With respect to the security things, there's a book which hopefully is actually presented here at the conference. I have not seen it yet, but I was promised by the publisher that it should be here. So we see in the next couple of days what is here. Anyway, there are some information there, and there are some further tutorials on different aspects, some of them also more on the defendability and security aspects at upcoming conferences, Spring School, and firstly, there's the CC UML workshop on Tuesday, satellite of this conference here. If you want to drop by and have a look, unless maybe you're participating anyway. And this will be happening again next year, at that time at the co-located with the SafeConf conferences, which is a defendability conference. And then, this is a more security-specific workshop, which is co-located with Popl upcoming early next year. And information can be found at this URL. Should be working shortly anyway. I just ordered the domain and I haven't set it up yet there. So maybe next week it should really be up. Until it's really up and running, you can just also find the web page with the tutorial information via my web page, which I think I noticed I didn't actually write down the slide, but on the next slide, I think. Yeah, this is the sort of project website. If you substitute the SECSD with my last name, then you get directly to my web page. And yeah, okay. And otherwise, if you don't find the material, just write an email. So something I just always mention is that we are always interested in, although of course I'm working at the university, as I mentioned already, we have a lot of collaboration with industry, so if you have any challenges, particular problems, which you think might be interesting for us to look at, then we're always happy about getting some motivation or some inspiration for problems arising in industrial development. Okay, so any more questions at this point? Otherwise, we should get to lunch as soon as possible. We're already a bit into the break. And thank you very much for your attention. And I hope you found this interesting. And if you could fill in these forms, then it would be interesting for me to get some feedback. Okay, thank you very much.